$5 in the $5 in the bottle. And oh, just being true, that's done to me. I'll be dead broke tomorrow morning with heartaches by the dozen. And a lady on my mind that's driving me crazy. Why do I need to see those blue eyes looking at me that way again? After the way she did me, it's a sin. How could she just walk out and leave me after all these nights in her arms? Look where I am. And I've got $2 in the jukebox, $5 in a bottle, 10 more just in case that don't do the trick. And I'll be dead broke tomorrow morning with heartaches by the dozen and a lady on my mind that's driving me crazy.
And welcome, everyone, to Blog Talk Radio's Your Money, Your Matters, brought to you by the Cornerstone Credit Union League, Cornerstone and Credit Union Foundation, and many others that join us into the show. We certainly are glad that you are joining us today on a very fine Tuesday. The phone number is 646-929-1020. That's 646-929-1020. And if you would like to get into the game, just give us a call, and you want to talk on the radio, just press the number one key, and that will raise your digital paw. I'll be able to see that. We'll be able to bring you on the air. And we will be talking about housing, as it is Housing Month this month. And we will be talking in that vein as to people getting into a lot of the housing. We had certainly talked over a period of time that today, June 16th, is what you would consider the day of formation. A lot of things were formed in June 16th for some reason or other over a period of time. In 1880, of course, the Salvation Army was formed in London, and that is an organization that has helped out many, many people when their homes have had a problem. And they have come to the aid and rescue of individuals to be able to find them more housing or a temporary housing and be able to equip them with some living quarters as well. And certainly other things happened. We came out of the recession in the 30s. We saw the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation formed. We saw the New Deal formed. A lot of that dealt with housing and getting the population back to a working population. Something that we have experienced in the 2008-2009 time frame, a similar occurrence, not as dramatic as the Great Depression of the 1930s, but pretty close and taking us much, much longer to be able to pull out of that as well. And certainly something that we struggle with in the housing industry, because housing does not snap back like it has in previous years. It's a slow climb back, and we're experiencing that. So there's a lot of things that have formed. You know, for all of you that are out at the baseball game and you're singing the song, the national anthem song of baseball, and with the lyrics "Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks." Cracker Jacks were formed in 1893 when an inventor decided to take popcorn and peanuts and take molasses and stir them all together and form the thing that is now, a national favorite and has been around for over 100 and some odd years, about 100 and 150 years. So it's a wonderful thing. We're going to bring Todd Mark. Todd Mark is out traveling, and so we're going to bring him in on the air and talk about housing and what's going on with housing. And so I think Todd is with us. I can hear the phone echoing in the background.
Sorry, I just left Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, and I should be at a stopping point here in about 5 or 6 minutes, then you won't hear the car behind me. But good to be with you today, Rick. So, and go ahead.
I was just gonna echo in the background. American Airlines 9313. You're ready for board.
Yeah. By the way, it's really really funny. As I was dropping off my family at the airport to go to Knoxville, Tennessee for a couple of weeks. And,
well, Eddie Rabbit was from Tennessee. I mean, he originally grew up in Brooklyn, New York, but eventually ended up in Nashville, Tennessee, and that really was his last name, Rabbit.
Wow. Well, hopping down the bunny trail, I guess. Well, anyway, so the last time I was with the kids going to Knoxville, Tennessee, I ironically ran into a radio personality, a longtime sportscaster on one of the Dallas sports talk stations. He's kind of a legend. And I knew him just by voice. I'd never seen him facially in my life, but he started talking, and we were on one of those vans, the shuttles, and I knew right away, and I said to my kids, I said, "Do you guys know who this is?" And he and we had a nice talk, and so he wished us goodbye. I'm telling the kids, I'm trying to pull up on my phone who this is, so I'm going to their website, the radio station website, to pull up his bio, and the kids thought that was really interesting. And I was waiting for something to load, and I decided I was going into the bathroom, and I did not realize that at the B terminal, I walked into the women's bathroom. and all this because I had a little bit of a – I hear I was excited to meet this big radio guy from Dallas-Fort Worth, and I could not tell the difference between the men's and the women's room. But all the women that were in line could tell the difference between me and – everybody else coming in.
Which just goes to show walking into a restroom and texting at the same time also doesn't work very well.
This is not a good thing. And
we've got, you know, one other thing I was going to mention is we have, you know, I see an area code on here, 512, which it brings the Austin, Georgetown University area. My guess is that is our good friend Jill Farr, and I'm going to bring her in just a moment as well. So I just thought I'd give you a heads up.
So we'll have me, Todd Mark from Navicor Solutions, a HUD intermediary to talk about housing. We're a housing association. And Jill Farr from Friends of Consumer Freedom, one of our great friends on the show, and a wonderful organization. So why don't you go make sure that that's with Jill?
Well, we will find out here momentarily because I'm going to open up that microphone on the area code 512, and we're going to find out real fast. As to who just joined on to the Your Money, Your Matters show. So,
now, what would happen if it wasn't me? Good morning.
Well, it would have been a
great introduction. But, you know, I mean, we're in Austin. It could be Governor Abbott. It could be State Senator Mike McCall. It could be any number of people. It could be... Nolan Ryan, you know, he lives just down the street from me here in Georgetown.
It could have been Jake from State Farm, so you never
know. That's right. You never know. But indeed, this is Jill Farr with Friends of Consumer Freedom. Glad to be with you today.
Yay. So and what's going on in our state capital then, Jill?
Well, there's a lot of work going on just about 30 miles south of me in the state capitol. Bills getting finalized and signed and ready for, I guess, some of that last-minute legislative goings-on that they do. We are also anticipating our first tropical storm bill. You know, it's in today's PC world, it's not just girls' names, finally. It's guys' names. So Bill is heading towards us. I believe he's already made landfall. And since all of us are saturated with all of the rain, they're predicting some flash flooding. So, and unfortunately, you're talking about housing. You know, there are people who have been displaced down here and continue to be displaced, and we see very heart-wrenching stories on the news every night about folks that have literally lost everything. And it's these organizations like the Salvation Army and the Red Cross and the United Way and other church-based organizations and so forth that really step in, especially in smaller communities. You know, they really rally around their friends. And I think that's part of the philosophy behind the credit union movement is literally people helping people and rallying together because there's strength in numbers and there's strength in unity. And so you know, that is what get. That's always what people say is our faith and our friends and family, and the help from people around us is what has gotten us through. So, great day to be talking about Credit Union Formation Day.
How about that? And you know, Joe, I go back and I think about some of these disasters that have occurred on the air in the almost 6 years that Rick and I and you've been part of as well doing the show. And I think back to the one that hit Moore, Oklahoma, and Rick, correct me if I'm wrong, was it Tinker Federal Credit Union?
Yes.
That in the midst of the tornado that was ripping through that city and laying significant wreckage, the employees at that credit union really put their instincts and their minds to work, and they ordered all the members that were there, all their customers, the clients that were there in the branch, into the safe, which probably is not a protocol from a financial security that you would normally think, but they were concerned about one thing, and that was human life. They ordered everybody into the safe, and when they figured the coast was clear, they opened the door, and that was all that was left standing, was that safe. And
yeah.
And I think about the actions of those employees that truly, they didn't just impact and touch lives, they saved lives that day. Hopefully with Bill coming across Texas, hopefully we won't have to hear tales of heroism and of our financial institution partners coming to the rescue, because hopefully this will pass and it will just be a significant waterfall. But if so, I've been inspired by some of those stories, and that one sticks out probably more than any.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Rick and I were both part of the Credit Union League and Credit Union Foundation during Katrina in 2005, and then later on Ike in 2008, and a couple of others. And you know, when you see the devastation that goes on, because we traveled to the coast personally to survey the damage, and it's appalling. You can't imagine it, and even pictures on the TV don't even do it justice. Again, same kind of thing, just story after story after story of people helping people and the credit unions helping people get to their money. And, you know, because when everything is down and you're used to a cashless society, people don't carry cash on them. And then you've got to be able to get some money out of your financial institution, and it may not work, or you may not be at the right one. So there is a lot of assistance going on there, a lot of credit union staffers that were invited to other parts of the state so they could continue with their business, and they helped them get them hooked up so they could continue to serve their members throughout the disaster, especially those who were displaced. So those are, you know, it was really a touching part, and I'm like you, Todd. It really inspired me when I saw how people just really rose to the occasion and just helped us any way they could.
You know, you get to see nonprofits at their best, whether it's nonprofit financial institutions like our credit unions, our members, whether it's other nonprofits. And in the last 15 years, I've worked for a consumer credit counseling service agency in three different cities. And what's fascinating is seeing the counseling of people that have been devastated, that have lost everything. In some cases, they've even lost their home. And some of those scenarios, they learn that their homeowner's insurance is not going to be enough because it's considered they were in a flood, they had flood damage and they did not have flood insurance. And nothing is worse than going through somebody and counseling them, and they think that they're covered, they've got insurance, and they're going to be able to weather the storm, and you realize that they're going to be starting over from scratch. My current nonprofit, Navicor Solutions, is based out of New Jersey, where 2 years ago, of course, the big Hurricane Sandy hit and caused devastation actually to many of our employees, two of which I know took direct hits and completely lost their homes. And something I've been so impressed with my employer, Napa Corps Solutions, actually does all the administration of state emergency funds for New Jersey for Sandy relief.
Really?
Still to this day. And it's nice when states can partner with nonprofits, in this case, in helping push out emergency funds to those that need it. And you think of the immediate need of those that are displaced and they're living in hotels and they need money for food. It's very different when you think about those that did take direct hits and they've lost everything. And how do they rebuild? So I always hope that those only belong in the movies. You want to see a disaster movie, go see San Andreas with Dwayne Johnson. But let's not see any more of those hit on the news anywhere in the United States, but specifically here in our great state of Texas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that one of the other statements from that, and it deals in the area of housing, is the insurance that one puts on their dwelling. We saw some national news coverage of people that were hit by the Hurricane Sandy, and their houses were inundated with water and inundated with other debris, sand and, you know, coral and basically, you know, the livestock of the ocean. What took place in some of their cases is that the insurance company who insured everybody all the way down the block, kind of, you know, in my opinion, and this, it's my opinion, reneged on their promise by not fulfilling the obligation of taking care of the homeowner and having individuals go out and do a survey of the home, come back with an engineering report that might say one thing, and then filing a different insurance report, which basically said that they weren't obligated to make any kind of payment to the homeowner because it wasn't covered under their policy. And I encourage everyone, when you are going to take out your homeowner's insurance, number one, make sure it's with a very reputable company. And in some of these instances, it was a reputable company, but make sure it's a very reputable company, that you've researched the company, and that you go through that policy with the insurance agent and maybe with someone else and read it. I understand that, you know, it might be 50, 60 pages long on very thin paper with very fine print and very tiny print. But you need to read the whole thing, because you'll get into a situation where you may get, for example, and I haven't done this, but I probably could, a lightning strike in my backyard hit one of the trees in my backyard, traveled obviously down to the ground, but when it hit the ground, it radiated out from the tree, and it came into the back of my house and took out the two circuits that lined the back of the house, the two electrical circuits that lined the back of the house. I could tell that from the circuit breakers that basically tripped. But before it would trip, anything that was connected into those electrical outlets that did not have a surge suppressor to it of any sort basically received damage. I mean, it received a very high amperage or electrical voltage into it and killed whatever it was. And basically that, you know, was a lot of sound equipment that was plugged into those things, computer that was plugged into it. And so all in all, so far, just replacing the gear that was plugged into it is in excess of $1,000 at this point. Now, I could, if I wanted to, of course, you know, file an insurance claim on that and have, you know, and pay my deductible and have some recovery on that. I'm not done replacing the gear as yet, because I find that as I go through and maybe turn on another piece of gear, like the a network card that was in there to do basically the network within the house, I found that was damaged as well. And so, I'm finding things all the time. So I'm waiting until I find everything and I've got everything under control before I may or may not file an insurance claim. It just depends on whether or not I want to replace it. But, again, one of those things that you want to check, because it may or may not be that in the policy, if the lightning bolt hits the house, You are covered. But if the lightning bolt hits a tree in the backyard and it comes across the ground and into the back of your house, you may not be. It depends upon how it's written.
You know, one of my big tips when it comes to insurance is you see commercials all the time, and they convey how much the insurance agent cares and how they're your friend and they're there to work with you. Oh, and listen to Jill. Already got sarcastic about it. Here's the deal. I don't care what company you go to. Just by signing a life insurance, a car insurance, a homeowner's insurance policy, this does not mean that you've made a new best friend. So just like with anything else in life, if you want to make sure that you've got good service, you need to have a relationship in place with these people long before you ever would need to make a claim. So,
mm-hmm.
so if you've got a homeowner's policy, make sure you've gone in and you've talked to the person or call them once a year and just say, hey, I'm one of your clients. Nothing's going on. I just want to see how you're doing. Guess what? If you do that, if you call them when you don't need them, they'll actually remember you because very few people do this. But you build a relationship. My mom, oh, my gosh, every holidays, she would bring baked goods over to our insurance agent. And guess what? Whenever we had a claim issue, they were always, it was like the commercial. They'd be out at the house themselves. They, oh, what can I do? What can we do to help you? So having the insurance itself is not enough. If you want to have an advocate, you actually need to have a relationship with the person. Don't assume
that
they're there to take
tip.
Care of you. Yeah. And not to mention, they're people too.
Yeah.
Do you want others? Mm-hmm. You have them do to you. So that works in business. That works with neighbors. That works in many areas of life. You get out of it what you put into it. So anywhere where you want to have a good relationship, you spend a little bit of time and it'll come back to you tenfold.
You know, and we have to remember, even on insurance, I mean, there, as we have talked on the show before, and especially during homeownership month, there are a lot of costs to owning a home, and one of those costs is the insurance policy on that, and that's something that a lot of the mortgage companies, when you sign, will ask to escrow for the cost of the insurance, because it's not cheap. And it's a big bill, and they don't want you at the end of the year realizing that you haven't saved up enough money to pay it, or you decide at some point in time that you're not going to have the insurance. Now, the insurance that you have on there, remember, if you want to buy it, you do not want to have the company that is issuing you the mortgage to have it, because the difference is this. If they issue it, they're protecting that dwelling and the value of their mortgage. That's what they're protecting. They're not protecting all of the goods that may be in that dwelling. So all of the things that you have collected over a long period of time, all the contents, as they call it, that are within your dwelling, are not normally protected by that insurance policy, and typically the premium on that policy is extremely high compared to you going out and getting one from a reputable company that not only covers the dwelling, but also covers the contents and the loss of those contents. And then, of course, you want to take a look at it from the standpoint of, is it covering the replacement cost of these contents, or is it covering the value of those contents when you bought them, and therefore, for example, a computer might have an average lifespan of 3 years, and at the end of the fourth year, it's lost somehow, maybe in a lightning strike or something like I experienced, and therefore it is of zero value as far as replacement cost is or zero value as far as the original purchase cost is concerned, and so you don't get anything for it. You need to be able to read those fine words in the contract to make sure that it's covering a replacement of things. And there are some things, of course, you don't want to do without. We've seen that happen when people have lost electricity over a long period of time with Hurricanes Katrina and Rita and Ike and other major storms. The refrigerator and freezer go out. That's the thing that's keeping the food within it from perishing. And so when the electricity goes out and that sits for a few days, The food within it begins to culture, and that culture inundates the refrigerator, freezer, and basically that is a worthless piece of equipment at that point in time. And you have to get a brand new refrigerator, freezer, and that's going to cost you a couple of bills. So make sure it covers replacement cost and not just the estimated value on a depreciated level.
So true. You know, when people are looking to buy a home, and even for renters that need renters insurance, but still when buying a home, they don't often think about the cost of the homeowner's insurance. And again, as a HUD housing counseling agency at Navicore, when we go through an 8-hour home buyer class with folks, one of the components we want to do is homeowner's insurance. And you say, how do you predict? It's really easy when you think about going out and going to zip codes. It's based on the history of the area. Is that an area that's hit by storms or is it in a flood zone? So geographically, where are you? What sort of risk does that pose? They're going to, of course, look at the size and the age and the quality of your structure. That all comes into play. They're going to look at whether or not you have a security system or not. Because they're not just insuring against natural disasters, but bad things, break-ins, and things of that nature. So it all comes into play with what your overall cost is going to be. And and many people, when they're shopping around, they think only about the principal and interest that they're going to be paying on a mortgage, and they don't think about taxes, they don't think about insurance, they don't think about HOA fees, they don't think about maintenance. But insurance is one of those that they need to account for. It's not cheap, and if you're a first-time homeowner, you may be shocked. You're like, oh, this is the cost of insuring the house, and that does not yet include umbrella coverage for the contents that are inside. And I guess it syncs up very well with when Jill brought up about storms coming. When you've got a homeowner's insurance policy, one of the things I love for people to do is walk through the house once a year, use your cell phone, and just do a 5 or 10 minute tour, a walking tour and a talking tour, and point out all the things that have decent or immense value to you, whether it's monetary value, even if it's intrinsic or intangible value, but just saying, here are the things that make my house up, and you walk through and save that on your phone or upload it into the iCloud. And then this way, if there's a worst case scenario, and you had a fire, you had a break-in, you were hit by a tornado or a hurricane, you could go to your agent and say, and here's my house, here's the structure, here's all of my my movies on the wall, here's my closet with all of my clothes, help me with the check to start replacing all this stuff. It will make it a lot easier than you saying, yeah, by the way, I had 100 suits from Men's Warehouse. Okay, let's just recreate that you bought all those. So can you go back through all of your credit card statements over the last 10 years and show us those purchases before we replace those? No, you say, I've got it on video. Oh, well, here's a check. So make it easy on them and make it easy on yourself as well.
Yeah, and speaking of some of the costs, I found just recently, looking out my front window, I noticed that not one but two of my neighbors on my cul-de-sac had put up for sale signs, and they put them up last week, and I thought, well, that's a really fine thing. I just get elected to city council, and already they're abandoning me. And so I thought, it's a great vote of confidence. We're getting out of here. But I thought, well, I'm going to take a look at this because, of course, a lot of people, when they were out this Sunday, and both of them had open houses at the same time, and so the street was just literally jammed with cars. I mean, absolutely jammed with cars. They had somebody out there on the street parking cars for people, a valet parking cars for people. Mm-hmm. There were that many people coming in to see these homes. And so I thought, well, I'm going to go out and take a look at it. I'm just curious as to what the selling price these days are and et cetera. What we have to remember is that there's always three prices to a home. There is the appraisal price, and obviously, and a person will come in and do that appraisal, and it's going to cost you up front about maybe $450 for them to come in, take a look at the home and all of the surroundings of the home, and then go compare it in the market space and come back to the financial institution with an appraised value of that home. Then there is the tax assessment value, and that's a different value. And homes don't typically sell for the tax assessment value. That's usually somewhat lower, if not significantly lower, than the actual appraised value of the home. Then there's the selling price. There's the actual selling price of the home. Now, the reason that I say that there are those three prices is this is what's going to happen for an individual that is going to, say, buy this home. They're going to go to a financial institution, and on the sheet that I have, the home is appraised for $330,000. And they're going to go to the financial institution, and they're going to want to get a loan to be able to buy this home that is now appraised at $330,000. However, the home right now is selling for $370,000 or $40,000 more. Now the company doing the financing, the credit union or the bank writing the mortgage, are going to write it for the value of the home, which is $330,000. If you buy it for $370,000, and you may have to do that because homes that are right now in the area are selling for a premium, but if you buy it for that, the difference between that is going to come out of your savings account. You're going to have to come up with the extra $40,000 in order to cover the difference between that and any down payment that was expected on the $330,000. And so if there's a 5% difference there, that might be another $15,000. So all of a sudden, you have to have $55,000 in cash to put down to be able to buy this home. Now, I thought, well, that's probably pretty crazy, but when I left this morning to come to work, I went by the home and took a look at it, and there was a sign on it that said it was sold in
that's
3 days. And my guess is it probably sold for more than $370,000.
That exact scenario just happened 1 week ago with my daughter and her family in McKinney. They listed their house on Friday and it went up, you know, early in the morning on Friday, and by the end of the day they had six showings at least and a couple more over the weekend. They finalized with an offer well over their asking price, and it's probably not going to appraise for that, and part of the offer that the buyers had made was that if it didn't appraise, they would bring cash to the table. The reason being, their house is a moderately priced house. They're actually moving out of their starter home and into a larger home to accommodate mm-hmm. their three growing boys rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, my daughter says, no, we need a playroom upstairs now.
Get them out of here.
That's right. What's really at a premium are moderately priced houses in the, say, 150 to 250 range. And those houses are not even going 3 days before they are sold. But that exact scenario happened with their buyer, and what happened, it was also just a true blessing in answer to prayer. They had made an offer on a home. They had already lost out on one offer because even though they offered more than the asking, it was a bidding war, and they didn't quite get there. And on the next house they found, they were told you need to come in with your best offer. And this is another tip. She wrote a letter to the seller, and she described their family of three young boys, and she is a nurse, and my son-in-law is an engineer, and they very much wanted to stay in their son's school district because he's going in high school in the fall, and they didn't want to move him at this point in time. And the realtor said definitely that letter was a tipping point. But anyway, their offer on their new house was accepted in the morning, and of course that's always a little nerve-wracking when you've bought a house and all of a sudden you've got another house too. And then they got the offer on the other. But here's another tip besides that letter writing. Because they had not overbought on their previous home, and I think I've mentioned on other shows that they went through some financial struggles because his company a few years ago in the housing downturn, being an engineering company, went through some serious struggles. But because they had not overbought, they were able to manage their finances and not lose their home. And once again, because they have been very careful and they've done the things, and because you say, oh, I can't possibly do that, but it can be done. You know, there are American families that are doing it. They had built their savings back up. And they were actually, and because they were not going to look for, they decided what they were comfortable with in paying, they were actually at this point able to qualify and get underwritten to make an offer on their new house and it not be contingent on the sale of their old house. So in other words, they could have qualified for a much larger loan, but they said, nope, not going to do it. We've got kids to send to college, and we've been down this road before, and we are not going to overspend. And they still bought a lovely home in a lovely neighborhood and still in the high school district. So I use them a lot, but they're really a success story because they're a modest American family of, you know, two parents and no dogs and three wild and crazy boys that I adore. But it can be done. It just takes a little discipline and setting those goals and sticking with it. So that, you know, they are truly a testament on they can do it, and now they're reaping the rewards and getting into that home with the playroom upstairs. Yay!
Wow.
And my daughter also said it has to have another bathroom. Those were her requirements.
And Grandma, just remember this, all the more room that needs to be filled up with toys now.
Well, you know, they've kind of outgrown that. They're kind of into their Legos and their sports, so they really need, you know, the garage space for, you know, all the basketballs and footballs and soccer balls and baseball bats. And I had two grandsons this summer that were named All-Stars on their T-ball teams and baseball teams, and my youngest, if it doesn't rain tonight, will be playing his All-Star T-ball All-Star game, and he is, my daughter said, his head is just about as big as his new room.
Wow.
But anyway, I wanted to point that out, that you know, you don't have to buy the most expensive house that you can qualify for. Mm-hmm. And in fact, because you do have those other expenses. And another thing is, you're always going to have, if you're into home ownership, you've got maintenance costs, and you've got to figure that into your budget. There is always some caulking to buy, or, you know, if somebody's knocked a baseball into the wrong direction, a foul ball, and it hits the window, you've got to replace that window, and you've got to paint where they have scuffed up the floors or the walls. You know, so that's another part of home ownership and one of those costs that, in addition to your mortgage and your insurance and your taxes, that you've got to consider. You know, speaking of the state is getting ready to raise the homeowner's exemption. So that is going to give some tax relief to Texas taxpayers. And, Rick, you may want to comment on that.
Oh, there's two sides to the argument, of course, on the tax relief. Certainly, it is a big number for the state government to be able to, for the legislators to come back and proclaim to their voting populace that they have lowered their property taxes when the bill gets signed. What it really means to the individual is probably a saving, an annual savings of about $170. And the impact onto a city will be about, for a city like Plano, which is a little over a quarter of a million, it probably means somewhere in the neighborhood of $4 to $5 million dollars coming into the coffers for the city. Let me give you the equation of how the city managers look at this. In any city, really, wherever it is in the United States, when the property taxes become lower and you see a little less money coming into the city, they equate it as firefighters and policemen. And so a $4.5 to $5 million hit on a city basically equates to 8 firefighters, 2 fire trucks, 6 policemen, and 6 squad cars. And those that will have to come out of the budget in order to be able to make the numbers balance, because, of course, cities are not like the federal government, and the state government is not like the federal government in that you have to have a balanced budget. Because that's basically how you are equated from a financial standpoint on Wall Street on whether or not you have a good bond rating or not a good bond rating. In addition to all of that, you are also rated as to whether you have a safe city and a well-protected city by insurance corporations. And the insurance corporations will take a look at it and give you ratings as well. That might be, for example, it might be an ISO 1 rating, which basically says you have a sufficient amount of police force and a sufficient amount of firefighters and the equipment to go along with those individuals to take care of any incident that could possibly take place within the city. And that gets you the lowest insurance premiums within the city, as if you're an ISO 1 city versus an ISO 2, which they begin to climb rapidly, and when you hit ISO 3, you can't afford the insurance within the city, and you see some cities that are like that. So although it saved me and you and others that are homeowners about $175 a month, it will cost the cities, and eventually it will it'll cost the people, the citizens that live within those cities. So it's a give and take type of thing. I may get a couple of votes because I did that in the state legislature, and I can come back to my district and say I lowered property taxes like I said I would. The opposite effect is the impact will be on the city budget where you live.
Yeah. You know, in honor of Home Ownership Month, there's another story I want to share. Somebody I was counseling last night. This is somebody whose grandmother passed away back in October. And she goes, so my uncle has been living at my grandmother's property. And she goes, because he's apparently been getting letters that the house is about ready to be possessed. And I said, well, that's not a very good letter to be receiving. What's the situation? And she goes, I don't really know. She goes, he was helping Grandma out with her bills, and they took out a reverse mortgage.
Oh.
And I said, I said, and again, a reverse mortgage, I'll give a definition in a few minutes, but reverse mortgage is not a scam, but it's a very unique way of capping the equity in your home while you're alive. But once the last person who owns a home passes away, generally the property through the estate is transferred over to the bank, or you know, the financial institution whom issued the reverse mortgage in the first place. And so here it is, and I'm thinking, wow, this is 8-9 months later. And this is just hitting them. It's like, wow, I'm surprised it took that long, actually. She goes, so what can he do to protect his rights in the house? And I said, why don't we look at the letter? And I'm like, hey, there are no rights in the house. The reverse mortgage had already been paid out. And upon death and selling of the estate, I said, your estate would have the choice to either pay back all that has been borrowed and make, you know, fulfill that loan, including the interest and fees of money that's been borrowed over time, or you give up the property. And there was a big sigh of an, oh. I'm like, well, you know, that's there's certain bills that may die with die with an estate, I said, but when it comes to borrowing against a property, yeah, that when you do a reverse mortgage, it really assigns that privilege to the ownership somewhere else. They didn't understand that the home was not going to be sold and that would be money that they would be sharing. But instead, that was money that had already been shared with Grandma and probably helped her live out for many years. So in that case, it probably served the right purpose. And I'm sure their grandmother was happy to have had access to those funds. But now the estate is looking and saying, oh, there's less for us. And I said, well, remember, your grandmother's life was not a culmination of saying, how much could I leave for my kids and my grandkids? It was, how do you live out and not be a burden to everybody else? So that was interesting. And her uncle is now figuring out how quickly he has before he has to vacate, because it's happening very soon. So with that, you know, for many years and still to this day, HUD mandates that if anybody who's 62 and older looking to tap the equity on their home through a product known as a reverse mortgage, it used to be known as a home equity conversion mortgage, a HECM, but they just use the terms reverse mortgage, that if for somebody to do this, they would have to go to a HUD-approved housing counseling agency like my organization, Navicor Solutions, but to go in and talk to specifically a reverse mortgage certified counselor. And the goal of a counselor is not to be pro or against reverse mortgage, because reverse mortgages are a very intricate, complicated product, and they're not for everybody. Whether or not it's right for you is much more dependent on your situation, your financial assets, your monthly bills, your heirs or family that are living there, and what your goals are for the money, and what your goals are for your estate. It's very complicated, and it's not so much of, are these good or bad? And so the counselor has to go through and really vet screen the candidates as saying, you know, is this appropriate for you? Say it's appropriate because too many stories, Jill, Rick, of grandmothers who have been vacated from a home they've lived in for 50 years because they didn't understand how the product worked, and they didn't have their name on a reverse mortgage, and when their spouse or partner died, they were suddenly asked to vacate and move out, feel like they're being foreclosed upon, and it's because they didn't understand, or they didn't have the appropriate vetting, and maybe their family thought that they were being scammed, and then they realized no, it wasn't a scam. They had access to money. They squandered or blew through the money, and there's nothing left now. One of the things that a reverse mortgage counselor is required to do is really to test the competency of that senior to make sure that they can advocate on their behalf. Because always from HUD, concern of mortgage fraud, but concern specifically that people could be targeting seniors who don't have all their mental faculties with them to make a good, sound decision on their own behalf. And so a reverse mortgage counselor will pepper in questions that just want to make sure that there is logic in the mind, that it's sound, that they may say, by the way, what year is it? Or who's the president of the United States? Or, how many kids do you have? And if they struggle with these things, that may be enough to say, listen, we can't do this right now, but please bring your kids or a power of attorney, and we'd be happy to discuss this with you. But we can't certify you or give you the certificate you need to move forward. Reverse mortgage is a complicated product. The way it works, just for listeners that may say, what is this? And generally, every time we've talked about this on the air, people say, I don't understand it. And with good reason. It's very complicated. But let's say, Rick, the Rick Grady Mansion, the palatial estates in Plano, that are valued at, let's say, $3 million. Is that close, Rick?
Yeah, it's somewhere south of there, but you're in the ballpark.
It's in the neighborhood. Yeah. That's a little tongue-in-cheek. But let's just say it was a $3 million property. Actually, for the sake of our listeners, why don't we say a $300,000 property? Let's say you own the house free and clear, and it would appraise right now at $300,000. Well, in a reverse mortgage, you get the benefit of having access to some of the equity in your home, but you also get to stay and live in the home and live until you choose to sell or you pass away. So you get access to some of the value of the home, but you also get to stay in the home. Now, many people say, I don't understand. If it's worth $300,000, why can't I have $300,000? And I say, you can. That's not a reverse mortgage. That's called sell your property.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to get all the assets to your equity, you sell it. What you're missing, though, is a place to live. A reverse mortgage allows you to age in place and not have to move. And you say, I want to live out my remaining years. So if you wanted that, they're saying you can tap out some of the equity, but you have to recognize that the person that is getting eventual ownership of your property, it's almost like there's accounting for you're also going to be paying them rent. Or the loss of value of if they could resell the home right away. And that's measured not in a term of a mortgage, but that's really based on an actuarial term of how long could you potentially live. So if you're 62 and your genes are on your side that you're going to live to be 100, they may say, wow, we're going to give them access to some amount of cash, but knowing that they could live here another 38 years, that's a long time. Whereas somebody who's much older and later in their eventual life cycle, let's say they're 89, they would probably be able to borrow more money from that property because the reverse mortgage lender would know this would be a much sooner time period that they're going to be able to get access to that property or that asset. So there's different amounts of money based on the timeline, and again, it's actuarial in nature. It has to do with the appraisal value of the home, and that you'll get a percentage. And it depends on whether that money is taken out as a lump sum or if it's taken out like an annuity with monthly or yearly payments, or if you take it out as a line where you can just borrow as needed against the overall available equity in the home. Very different, complicated product. It almost feels like no two are the same. And this is why there's a lot of education and counseling required on the upfront. It's not for everybody. If the goal is to have a property in place for an estate, you would never do that. If you have adult children that expect to live there after the adults pass on, after the owners pass on, you would never do that. I think of special circumstances like a special needs child. You want to make sure that the house is left for them, especially a specially modified home. You would never do a reverse mortgage. You want that owned free and clear, and that it would pass directly to them upon your death. So anyway, it's a very complicated product. It's way too much to fully explain even in one show, but hopefully that's an overview. So from an overview standpoint, Jill, Rick, I know you've each had experience either talking about or seeing other people go through these. What are some of the things that you think are most important to pass on to our listeners about the pros and cons of a reverse mortgage?
Jill, I'll let you take it if you want.
Well, I think one of the things that was a red flag, and I don't know if this is true in this case, but I think that when you have, you've got to not only vet or research the company, but you also need to really sit down and talk with your family, and either get them to understand where you're coming from in trying to get a reverse mortgage, or help them to understand and know that these are what your wishes are, and they may not be getting that house because, you don't want to have a bunch of angry, bitter children who won't come and take care of you in your old age. But I think with the help of a reverse mortgage counselor, you need to make sure that the family understands what you're doing if you elect to do that. On the other hand, if there are resources that can be made, if that person needs some resources to help them get by and there are other family members that could possibly assist with that, that might be a solution as well. So I think bringing in, especially your closest or most trusted, because let's face it, families come in all shapes and sizes with all kinds of people, and just because they're your kid doesn't mean that they're not, as another financial advisor called, your greedy unwashed heirs that I hear on the radio. He says that in jest. But it is true. You've got to make sure that you've got some family members that you can trust to help you with the decision either way. And if you don't have a family member that you can trust, a trusted advisor, and that may not be a caretaker. That may need to be a professional of some sort, especially with a consumer counseling agency, possibly even someone. A lot of churches offer, financial counseling through volunteers at churches. So it may not be a family member, and be careful if it's your caretaker as well, your hired caretaker. So I think you've got to make sure that the people that are helping you make that decision are trustworthy and will help you make the best decision for you, because it is for you. You don't owe anyone anything, and you've got to make sure that your life in this stage of your life is going to be the best possible situation for yourself and your spouse or partner.
And I might add, if you're thinking of doing this, you might want to go out to there is a website called reversemortgage.org. Now, I haven't explored the website enough to give a recommendation on it one way or another, other than it does say that it is an organization. So I'm assuming that without any investigation that it might be in the neighborhood of 501c3 or something of that nature, but that may not be true. But it's called reversemortgage.org, and they have a calculator out there, and it allows you to place within the calculator various things like the value of your home, the amount of principal that is left on the home if you have a mortgage and it's you still have principal on it, the amount of your monthly payment, et cetera. And what it will do is calculate the amount of money that you would actually get in a check every month. Now, there's some caveat in here, and I would say when you do the calculator, it's very interesting to take a look at it, because it produces 27 lines of numbers, and those 27 lines of numbers indicate several things to me. Number one, you are paying money back to this individual as a margin on giving you the notice they didn't say it's an interest rate, but you are paying back to them a margin on the money that you are getting each month. Also, you can't assume that what they're going to do is just sit there and hold on to your mortgage. My guess is they take all these things, bundle them together, put them into the securities market, and they get money out of the securities market to be able to fund money to you in a reverse mortgage situation. And so if, for example, at some point there is some ripple in the economy and this company were to go out of business, the individuals that are holding those mortgages may come back to you and say, we would like to repossess your home.
This is all true. All true. So, Jill, you said something that I think is great advice. If you know that a senior in your life, a parent or grandparent, is considering this, you need to know it's not a scam, but you need to be a vested, interested party. As long as you're not the greedy child, but you've got your parents,
greedy unwashed heir.
The greedy unwashed heir. But if you've got your parents or grandparents' best interest in mind, go with them to sit down and talk to a counselor so you can learn about this. Any legitimate HUD-approved housing agency will not only they'll welcome, but they'll encourage you as the kids or grandkids or potential heirs to understand this, so you don't think that your parents are being taken advantage of. Remember, a counselor is not a lender. We HUD agencies don't do lending of any sort like that. So they would just be doing the education on the father front. But knowledge is power. Just as the message of our show is every week. So be a part of that process.
Well, we want to thank everyone for joining us today, and we certainly want to thank Todd Mark with Navicor Solutions and Jill Farr, Friends of Consumer Freedom, who dialed in and participated on the show today. It was certainly great to have both of you on today talking about a very important issue. We'll continue talking about homes during Home Ownership Month next week on Your Money, Your Matters. So stay tuned. If you have questions, you can always blog them into us, put them on our website. You can join us in the show and press the number one key and talk with us, or you can go into the chat room. Lots of ways you can get information back to us so that we can help you with information in your daily life. So enjoy your day. Enjoy your week. We will talk to you in 1 week on Your Money, Your Matters.